Welcome back to Off the Bench, everybody. I'm Brandon Carney, alongside no one. My esteemed co-host, Pat, is indisposed. I think he's in Oregon or something. Whatever he told you guys last week is where he's at. So for any of you tuning in live, seeing my beautiful face right now, I apologize that it is encompassing literally all of your screen and that there is not another person to, break it up, mitigate it a little bit. But look, Pat will be back with us next week, and we will dive into some more draft reaction. Honestly, it'll probably be more fantasy focused next week so that we can get, you know, some of Pat's opinions on that stuff. So we'll hold off on most of the fantasy analysis this week. It'll be a little bit more of just draft reactions in general, my thoughts on what every team did. And so also we'll probably do a draft of our favorite fantasy rookies for this upcoming season. Last year we did that draft as well, and I believe I actually took Jahmyr Gibbs with the first pick in that little draft of just our favorite fantasy rookies for that year. And I remember feeling like kind of crazy about it shortly after, and then by the end of the season, I don't think it was that crazy. I believe Bijan ended up outscoring Jahmyr Gibbs, but Jahmyr Gibbs ended up doing pretty well for himself. So we'll get into our thoughts on those fantasy rookies next week when Pat returns from bumblefuck wherever he is. But this year's draft, it was an interesting one, for sure. Thank you to anyone who tuned in for the live stream as I live reacted to the first round of the draft. And also, quick little mock draft review from last week's show. Our mock draft was much, much better than it was last year. I think Pat was correct when last year he said we only got like three picks correct between the two of us, which was pretty embarrassing. This year, we got a lot more right. So we got the first three picks correct: Caleb Williams, Jaden Daniels, Drake May, pretty chalk first three picks. And then we also got Malik Nabers to the Giants correct, Rome Odunze to the Bears, Byron Murphy, who upon review of last week's show, Pat kept calling Byron Mitchell, and I did not correct him. That's my bad. Byron Murphy to the Seahawks. Even though he didn't know his name, he did get the selection correct. And then we also got a couple other landing spots right, just with the wrong picks. Cooper DeJean to the Eagles, that did end up happening, just not until the second round. We had him mocked there at number 22. And then Bo Nix to the Broncos, we had conjured up some sort of trade that got the Broncos a pick later in the first round where they took Bo Nix. I think it was the 24th pick from the Cowboys, but they ended up reaching on Bo Nix a little bit, got him at number 12. I think it's a reach. I mean, we'll talk about it in a little bit, but ultimately the landing spot certainly makes sense. The Broncos needed a quarterback. And then we also were correct about Xavier Worthy going number 28 overall, just to the wrong team. And I don't know exactly what the Bills were thinking with that one, but to each their own, I guess. I don't know. They needed a receiver, and they got one. It just, you know, wasn't him. Okay, couple big things I want to talk about before we get into the rest of the draft. Also, just a quick note here. This might be a slightly shorter show than normal, just because it's just me yapping, and I don't know if I'm going to be able to yap for an hour and a half. Maybe I will. There's a lot to talk about with the draft, but still, I don't have any time to just sit by and let Pat flap his gums about stuff either. So, okay, big things I want to talk about before we get into the rest of the draft. First of all, the Falcons drafting Michael Penix Jr. at number 8 overall. I don't really know where to even begin with this one. So if you tuned into my live stream, you will have seen me literally get up from my desk, take a lap, and show potentially more surprise than you've ever seen in your life. Look, I had talked about the possibility of the Falcons, you know, drafting a quarterback somewhere to sit behind Kirk and kind of learn from him and, you know, plan ahead, sure. But this was not the pick I wanted them to do it with. This was not even, I would go as far as to say it's not even the prospect I wanted them to do it with. I like Michael Penix Jr. as a player more than I like, say, J.J. McCarthy, but J.J. McCarthy's a lot younger. So if you are going to make that kind of pick and take a quarterback in number 8, which is still a bad decision, but if you're going to do it, at least take someone younger who can feasibly sit for 2 or 3 years and not be approaching their age 26 or 27 season by the time they finally get a chance to start. Just didn't make any sense to me. Overall, I just think it shows a complete lack of direction and focus by the Atlanta Falcons. Like, this quote from general manager Terry Fontenot really drove me nuts. He said, "We do something else right there, and then we win for the next few seasons, and then Kirk decides to hang up the cleats, whenever that is. Then Michael Penix is somewhere playing at a really high level, and we're in quarterback purgatory. We don't have a quarterback." That was his quote. That was his justification for drafting Michael Penix Jr. at number 8, is that he didn't want to end up in quarterback purgatory, 4 or 5 years from now. To which I say, you need to worry about winning now. Like, to completely brush over a portion of the Falcons' next few seasons. What he said was, we win for the next few seasons, and then Kirk hangs up the cleats, and then we're in purgatory. No, you need to focus on that first part. Like, you don't just brush over that as if that's some kind of given, like that's some kind of, something you've already been doing is winning. Like, this is a team that has not won anything significant, literally, in franchise history. It hasn't won its division in, I believe, 3 years. And he's just talking about, like, oh, it's just a given that they're going to win for the next couple years. And it's not. Like, not at least winning anything of note. Like, this team, with Kirk Cousins in the fold for the next 2, 3, 4 years, however long it is, the Falcons have a chance to be a Super Bowl team if they put the right pieces around him. Instead, they decided to be half in, half out of that commitment and say, we're also going to look ahead instead of maximizing this team that we have now. The Falcons were dead last in the NFL last season in pass rush win rate, and they passed up Dallas Turner and Leiatu Latu, who are sitting there on the board, for a quarterback who will not factor into their plans until this era of their roster is over with. They're operating as if they are some kind of defending Super Bowl champion without any holes that they need to fill, any real major adjustments they have to make. They're operating as if they have the luxury to just look toward the future with that number 8 overall pick. They don't have that luxury, and now they've burned the number 8 overall pick, an incredibly high pick for a team that on paper is as talented as they are likely to be and as successful as they're, hoping to be next season. And they didn't decide to draft a difference maker to really, put them over the top or get them to be an actual sort of favorite coming out of the NFC. It doesn't make any sense to me. I think it was a absolutely terrible decision. Like, it's just such a weird mismanagement of priorities. And it also got me thinking about, the Alex Smith, Patrick Mahomes situation. Because I'm trying to be objective and I'm trying to understand. And I remember that pick, right? The Chiefs were like a pretty good team with Alex Smith, and then they drafted Patrick Mahomes at, what was it, number 10 overall. And nobody at the time understands it, because Patrick Mahomes is a project quarterback that was a team in the Chiefs that was trying to compete as they were. So why are you not getting a piece to win now? So let's say, best case scenario, right, Michael Penix Jr. is the next elite quarterback in this league. And that's why they made the pick, because they just felt like they couldn't miss out on it. The difference is that Alex Smith was already on the Chiefs roster, and they felt like they needed a piece to, eventually get them to that next step, because they didn't feel, I guess, that they could do it with an Alex Smith-led roster. The Falcons brought Kirk Cousins in this offseason. You could just not do that if you feel like you want to bring in a high upside quarterback like Michael Penix Jr., who is ready to play right now. And now he's not going to be able to play right now. He's one of the oldest quarterbacks in this draft class, and now he's not going to get to play for a few years. This is not a Jordan Love situation. Jordan Love was 3 years younger when the Packers drafted him to sit behind Aaron Rodgers. Like, it's just a terrible, terrible misalignment of decisions. It felt like one regime made the choice to draft or to sign Kirk Cousins, and then like another regime came in and like disagreed with that choice and then drafted Michael Penix. The two decisions don't work together for a team that hasn't won anything in recent memory. It doesn't make any sense. They should be all in on trying to win right now. There were players on the board that could help them and contribute to them winning right now, and they decided not to do that. And they did a disservice to both themselves and to Michael Penix Jr. Michael Penix Jr. could be out there, starting for a team this year, and instead, he's just going to be sitting there behind Kirk Cousins for who knows how long, and Kirk Cousins is going to inevitably feel weird about it. Just a very bad move overall, and it doesn't make any sense to me. So let's move on to something a little more positive, a different quarterback move. I'm sure you guys are dying to hear about my opinion on the Patriots draft, and I couldn't be happier. Like, you guys probably in the shows leading up to the NFL draft heard me talk about Drake May and how I wanted him and how that was my sort of, like ideal fit and ideal player for the Patriots to go and get. And I really wanted him, and we got him. So I'm thankful that there were no shenanigans, no buffoonery, whether that would be the Commanders taking Drake May or, you know, the Patriots stupidly trading out of that spot. They would have needed an absolutely massive haul to trade out of that spot and deprive themselves of the opportunity to get a potential franchise quarterback. And any of the deals I saw that were kind of floated out there from the Giants, from the Vikings, I wasn't really moved by them. I mean, it was basically, you know, their first rounder that year, a future first rounder, and then a second rounder. And like, yes, that's a pretty good like amount of capital, but that is not enough to put off this rebuild for another year. Or that is not enough to say, we don't want Drake May. We're going to get, you know, JJ McCarthy at 6 or at 11 or whatever they would have ended up doing. I think Drake May was the right pick. I think the Patriots also nailed the rest of the draft, at least in terms of the positions they targeted. We came into this draft knowing we needed three things: a potential franchise quarterback, a bunch of receivers for him to throw to, and a bunch of linemen to protect him. And we did not spend any pick until the sixth round on anything but those three positions. It was two receivers, two linemen, and Drake May. That encompassed the entire Patriots draft haul of the first four rounds. Didn't have a fifth round pick. And it went ideally. The only thing I would have done differently, but again, I'm just going to kind of leave this one up to the people that are better at the scouting thing than me, is that I would have probably, I expected to see A.D. Mitchell be the first receiver pick rather than Jalen Polk out of Washington. Seeing it be Polk surprised me a little bit, but you know, a lot of draft analysts and draft heads that I greatly respect seem to really, really like both the Polk pick and Javon Baker out of UCF. Javon Baker is also wholeheartedly embracing the New England mindset already, saying he's going to get the Patriots back to, you know, where they want to be, and that he hates defensive backs. The guy is, he's got the right attitude, and I'm very, very excited to see what he can offer this team. And then the one pick that did surprise me quite a bit for the Patriots was the Joe Milton pick. But I don't hate it. I think it's you know, Joe Milton is a raw prospect. He is a super, super raw prospect. He's basically all arm strength and, you know, some good mobility, but has no accuracy, essentially, is what he is. And look, in the sixth round for a team that desperately needs a franchise quarterback, I don't mind taking a guy that seems to have a bunch of really good tools and just seeing what you can get out of him. Like, it's such a low risk, high reward type of selection. And as much as I'm on the Drake May train and I'm going to be rooting for him, and I think and hope that he can be a franchise quarterback, like, there's always the chance that any quarterback you take high in the draft isn't going to work out. The bust rate on highly drafted quarterbacks is insane. And so for a team like the Patriots that just is in desperate need of a quarterback that can, you know, make plays and be a franchise guy, I don't hate taking a stab at another guy later in the draft. Do I expect Joe Milton to, you know, come out and end up as the Patriots quarterback of the future instead of Drake May? No, of course not. That is not what the odds say is going to happen. There's a reason Joe Milton was available in the sixth round, but guys pop up randomly all the time in late rounds that end up being, you know, really productive quarterbacks in the NFL. So I don't mind the dart throw at all, considering they address all their other needs in the earlier rounds. And hey, let's take as many stabs at finding this sort of franchise quarterback that we possibly can. So I like the Joe Milton pick. Some other first round highlights that we had, again, Caleb Williams, Jaden Daniels, and Drake May were the expected top three. So I mean, that was nothing surprising there. And then the pick right after that, the Cardinals taking Marvin Harrison Jr. They stood their ground. They did not trade away their pick like there were so many rumors that they would possibly do. They got Marvin Harrison Jr. And let me tell you, Marvin Harrison Jr. is going to be a problem in fantasy football, an absolute problem. I said we're not going to spend, you know, a ton of time analyzing the fantasy stuff in this show, but it has to be said about Marvin Harrison that he's stepping into a situation with a quarterback in Kyler Murray, who I think is set out to prove himself this year. Kyler's still young. It actually surprised me. He's only 26 years old. I didn't think he was like pushing 30 or anything, but 26 felt a little younger than I anticipated. And Kyler, you know, coming off of a season that was, he didn't get into games until later because of his injury. And I think he's going to try to get back to who he was. And now he's got a number one receiver basically stepping into that DeAndre Hopkins role. And the only real competition for targets is going to be Trey McBride, who I love Trey McBride as well. And I think there's going to be room there for, you know, two pass catchers to be fantasy relevant. But otherwise, like, I'm not too worried about Michael Wilson eating into his production. I'm certainly not worried about Greg Dortch eating into his production. I think Wilson's going to be a nice complimentary number two. But in general, like, Marvin Harrison stepping into a spot where he's going to be getting double-digit targets probably in most of their games. So this is going to be maybe one of the most instant impact rookie receivers we've seen in a while. And I'm glad the Cardinals stuck in their spot and got him, because I don't think there was many other situations out there that would have been as friendly for Marvin, at least, to produce this year. The Los Angeles Chargers, after that, did the funniest thing possible. I joked about it, you know, in the last few weeks about them taking Joe Alt specifically instead of a receiver, which they obviously desperately needed. And I guess it's on me for not doing enough sort of research and poking around and seeing what the Chargers were expected to do, because it seemed like no one was really surprised by the Joe Alt pick. And from a prospect perspective, that makes sense. Joe Alt is a great player, arguably the most can't-miss prospect in this draft. I mean, just from the name Joe Alt, the guy sounds like he's going to be an all-pro for the next 15 years. I think it's just because his name reminds me of Joe Thomas, and he's a big old lineman. But still, it's a good pick, and they're solidifying a part of the team that obviously Jim Harbaugh is very much prioritizing. So it makes sense, but it's still pretty funny because the Chargers need receivers pretty badly. Like, losing Keenan Allen and Mike Williams this offseason left them with just Quentin Johnston and Josh Palmer at wide receiver, and then Will Disley and Hayden Hurst at tight end. So it was like, okay, we're going to mock them to get, you know, Malik Nabers or Brock Bowers or somebody to be that 1A target for Justin Herbert. And they didn't get that. They took Joe Alt. Lucky for them, though, they did get Ladd McConkey in the second round. I think they were going to take a receiver with that pick regardless after they passed up on one in the first. I mean, there's a certain point where even Jim Harbaugh has to accept that O-line is not the literal only position he can focus on, and the run game isn't the only part of the game that they can focus on. So they were going to take a receiver there, but I think they lucked out with a guy of Ladd McConkey's stature, not literal stature, but, you know, his profile to be there. I think there was a chance that there were some much just higher risk, maybe lower percentage hit rate receivers on the board there, and they would have had to choose from one of those guys. But instead, they got Ladd McConkey, who is going to be, I think, right out the gate, Justin Herbert's favorite target. And he is going to be one that it's going to be tough to, like, not overrank in fantasy football as well, because, like, you look at just his route running and the way he approaches the game. Who's he competing with? Like, unless Quentin Johnston, I do think, will take some level of step forward this year, but he had such a brutal rookie season. Josh Palmer is just the definition of a jag, just another guy. He's just kind of there doing his thing as the wide receiver three. Ladd McConkey has every opportunity to step in there and be their clear number one guy. And you know, that's tempting from a fantasy perspective when you can see how big the role could be, but you know that the guy was only spent second round draft capital was spent on him, because that is a factor as well generally when you're looking at how much teams like a guy. But I think Ladd is going to be very, very, very interesting in fantasy football this year, and I think is heading for a very productive rookie season. Now, the guy that I mocked to the Chargers in some different mocks, I think in our mock, we actually had Marvin Harrison going to the Chargers because we had the four straight QBs off the board with a trade mixed in with the Cardinals. But Malik Nabers, rest in peace, my brother. I am so sorry. Malik Nabers has been cursed with having to go play with Daniel Jones and the New York Giants. Silver lining here is that it is a similar outlook as Marvin Harrison, strictly in the sense that he's going to be stepping into all the targets he can handle. Darren Waller is in fact retiring, and the only receivers that Malik Nabers is going to be competing with in New York are the guys that have just been there and kind of clogged things up forever. You know, Darius Slayton, Wandale Robinson, whatever's left of Sterling Shepard, if he's still there. Malik Nabers is going to probably be the primary target right out of the gate, but the question is, what value does that have when it's Daniel Jones throwing you the ball? We saw that in the first couple weeks of last season when both DJ and Darren Waller were healthy, You know, we had heard all training camp and all preseason that that Waller was about to have a huge year because he was the only guy in the Giants, and he and Daniel Jones had this great connection, and then it just fell flat before DJ got hurt. I slandered him enough on this show. You guys know this by now, but I don't believe Daniel Jones is the guy. I believe this year, the fact that the Giants did not come out of this draft with a quarterback this year is going to be essentially a loss for them. This is a year that the Giants are going to burn by not accepting the mistakes that are on their roster. They're just kind of blindly heading into the year, you know, hoping Daniel Jones can do something. But it feels like we're going head on toward, you know, at the end of the season or in the middle of the season, like Daniel Jones getting benched, the coaches getting let go. I don't think that'll happen in the middle of the year, but like this is a managerial sort of failure by going into another year with Daniel Jones as your quarterback. It was a failure just to extend him in the first place, but you know, to just keep kind of pretending things are okay when they're not, I think that's a mistake by the Giants. And Malik Nabers is unfortunately caught up in this situation. If and when you can help it, you know, from, again, approaching this from a fantasy perspective, drafting players that are on good teams or at least ascending teams is optimal. I think we get caught up sometimes in thinking, oh, I'm going to draft this guy who's going to have a ton of volume on a bad team just because they're going to have garbage time and, you know, he's the only guy. Someone has to score. No, they don't. The team can just go 3-and-out every drive. That happens a lot for really bad teams, and I think that's going to happen a lot for the New York Giants. Malik Nabers has so much talent, but I don't think he's really going to get to showcase it until the Giants bring in a new quarterback next year, whoever that may be. Maybe they get in on the Dak Prescott sweepstakes. Who knows? Although I think the Cowboys would sooner die than give Dak to a division rival. I mean, I guess if they're moving on from him, then maybe they don't like him. But we'll see how that goes. Not having Dak get an extension yet is a little bit weird vibes as well. All right, continuing down the first round, J.C. Latham pick makes a ton of sense for the Titans. Pat and I mocked Joe Alt to the Titans, projecting that he would be available at 7, but he wasn't. So the Titans went with a different tackle. And again, it just continues on their path of trying to, for some reason, compete with Will Levis as their quarterback. And look, maybe I'll eat this one. Maybe I'll be totally wrong. It just surprised me again that they have gone so all in with the kind of the Levis regime, so to speak. But with all the free agent moves that they've made and the trade for Legarius Sneed, they are clearly trying to make some kind of playoff push here and maybe even try to take the AFC South title away from the Texans at this point. I mean, this is going to be a hell of a division race. I'll say that, because the Titans have decided that they are taking it very seriously. Then you've got the Texans, who seem to be the prohibitive favorite to win not only the division, but, you know, maybe meet the Chiefs in the AFC Championship game. They're one of the top favorites in the whole league. Then you've got the Jags, who are just, I feel like they continue to just have the pieces in place, and they're just trying to really make the right, like, micro moves to finally get to where they want to be. So the Jags are in that division as well. And then you've got the Colts, who are going to be, you know, bouncing back in a new season with Anthony Richardson, hoping that he can stay healthy. They made some great draft picks as well, getting Leiatu Latu on the defensive side and then getting A.D. Mitchell as another weapon for Richardson. And again, if Richardson can stay fully healthy in the draft or can stay fully healthy this season, he's going to be scary. Like, he's going to be a can win you games on his own type of player. And yeah, the AFC South, not to say it's going to be the most competitive division of all of them, because I think the AFC North probably has them beat, and possibly the NFC North, but it's going to be up there, and it's going to be one of the most fun ones to follow, just because the teams are all either ascending or, in the Jags' case, just kind of trying to, you know, stay there. We thought the Jags, with Trevor Lawrence under center, were going to be the favorites in this division for the foreseeable future. And then the Texans said, just kidding, we're going to get C.J. Stroud and have him be immediately a borderline top five quarterback in this league and be better than Trevor. Anthony Richardson's going to be electric, and the Titans are just going to try to bring in a bunch of pieces and see what happens. But J.C. Latham as a pick for them makes a ton of sense as they continue their attempt to be competitive. Rome Odunze, awesome pick for the Bears. We mocked that one as well. It on paper, you might look at it and see, you know, DJ Moore and Keenan Allen as the starting receivers and not think that it's super necessary. But Keenan Allen is getting older. He's probably only going to be around for 2, maybe 3 years, at least at a super highly effective level. And I mentioned this last week when we mocked Odunze to the Bears, that what better player for a guy like Rome Odunze to step into and learn from than Keenan Allen? And he can do it with a little bit lower pressure. Like, he's going to be there. He's going to be out there in three receiver sets, obviously, but he's going to be their third receiver as long as both Moore and Keenan Allen are healthy. Odunze is not going to be relied on to make a ton of plays early. And I think just that lack of pressure and just the ability for him to be kind of brought along slowly while also being on the same exact timeline as Caleb Williams is going to do wonders for him. It's great for them to have a connection that, you know, is contracted to their team for the next 5 years, assuming they pick up the fifth year option on Odunze when that time comes, and Williams, of course. Just a very smart pick, a nice way to kind of complete that core of their offense going forward and just continue to surround Caleb Williams with weapons. Caleb Williams, we'll talk about him next week as well, I'm sure, but for fantasy, he becomes very, very interesting just because of the weapons around him, and then obviously you've got his own talent to factor into that as well. I love the pick with Rome Odunze to the Bears. J.J. McCarthy was, I think, a necessary pick for the Vikings. I'm sure they are thanking their lucky stars that they didn't have to trade up to get him. He just ended up sitting there for them at 11. And again, a necessary pick. I don't think McCarthy has the upside that the quarterbacks ahead of him have, including Michael Penix. But they had to do something to try to keep Justin Jefferson around and show that they are, you know, making a concerted effort to compete and continue to put out a competent football team on that field every week. And maybe J.J. McCarthy can turn into the guy for them, but at the very least, they needed to show Justin Jefferson that they were trying, because Jefferson has been frustrated, you know, at times throughout the Kirk Cousins era. I can't imagine how frustrated he would have been in a full season with Sam Darnold, where the Vikings, you know, if they didn't draft a quarterback, like where they didn't even show that they were trying to get a better player than Sam Darnold. So I think JJ was absolutely a necessary pick for the Vikings. Now, the Bo Nix pick was a reach. I made a video about it. It was a reach, but I suppose maybe possibly I could be convinced that it was necessary, because I don't think anybody really had mocked, you know, Bo Nix being the best quarterback available at number 12. We can all thank the Falcons for that. I think we expected Caleb, Jaden Daniels, Drake May, and J.J. McCarthy to all be gone by the Broncos pick at 12, but we also expected Penix to be there along with Bo Nix, which I think would have pushed Nix a little further down the board. I don't know that the Broncos would have taken Penix there. I don't know what exactly would have happened, but the reports are that the Broncos were the only team with a first-round grade on Bo Nix, which is not a great look for you to spend the number 12 pick on a guy that no one else thought deserved to be a first-rounder. But if you look at the Broncos, you have to wonder, would the Raiders, you know, even though they didn't have a first-round grade on Bo Nix, would they have spent the pick right after the Broncos at number 13 and taking Bo Nix for themselves, knowing they needed a quarterback? Now, if they just don't think Bo Nix is that guy, again, maybe the grade thing is true and they didn't have a first-round grade on him, and the Raiders could have said, hey, we don't think he's that good. It's not worth wasting number 13 on. We're just going to go into next year with Gardner Minshew and Aiden McConnell and figure out the quarterback after the fact. I think that is a possibility, but I understand the Broncos may be getting some cold feet, not wanting to trade behind a division rival that also needed a quarterback. It was just kind of a game of chicken that the Broncos ended up losing. And if Bo Nix doesn't work out, it's going to look like a massive reach. And I think overall there was a way to kind of maximize that draft capital if they could have found a trade to just go back a few spots and get some assets and just hope the Raiders don't take Bo Nix. And if they do, oh well. Like, if nobody else in the NFL other than maybe the Raiders on top of the Broncos thought that Bo Nix was worth a first rounder, then that kind of tells you you're not missing out on much. And I suspect that Bo Nix's career in the NFL just might play out in a way that shows he was not worth the number 12 overall pick. So wasn't a huge fan of that one, even though there was a positional need. Brock Bowers to the Raiders. This one surprised me and makes me a little bit sad for fantasy football. There were so many other great landing spots Brock Bowers could have gone to that would have been so much more optimal for fantasy football. Obviously, you've got the Jets. I felt like he was almost earmarked to go to the Jets at number 10. And then you've got the Chargers, which I, as the process went on, the likelihood became less and less for Brock Bowers to go quite as high as number 5 where the Chargers were sitting. But, you know, early on in the process, it was something that was talked about. And, like, thinking about Brock Bowers with Justin Herbert, that is just arousing in itself, 100% arousing. But and then you got the Jets, you know, Aaron Rodgers throwing to him alongside Garrett Wilson in the passing game, not really factoring in Mike Williams too much because he's just hurt a lot. But we had heard so many situations where Brock Bowers could have stepped in, been maybe the top target or at least, you know, number two target on a very high volume, high efficiency passing offense. And instead he goes to the Raiders, where he probably will be the number two target behind Devontae Adams. But you got Jacoby Myers there. Honestly, I could see Jacoby Myers and Brock Bowers' target share kind of ending up the same, with possibly Jacoby even a little higher. And on top of that, you have a quarterback situation that is just absolutely not ideal for production. Brock Bowers kind of went into a spot that just makes me feel like I'm just hearing like the womp womp sound effect in my head. I guess it could be worse, like if he went somewhere that already had a completely established receiving tight end option, but he went somewhere that has a decent one. Like the Raiders just spent a second round pick on Michael Mayer last year, and we were talking about how, oh, Michael Mayer has a path to maybe be, you know, a decent quarterback or quarterback, a decent tight end option and receiving threat for the Raiders. And then now this just kind of muddies up both of their outlooks. Like, they're both going to be on the field a lot, but it makes it so much harder to try to project one guy to have, like, a super, super meaningful role, that at least one that excites you in fantasy football, you know, this season. I expected the Raiders to take possibly a quarterback there or a lineman. I did not think Brock Bowers was really on the menu for them, but it was. And I know our boy Pat, we'll get his thoughts on it next week, but I saw his tweet about it, and he is very excited, which understandably so. I mean, Brock Bowers is an incredible player, and anytime you can just kind of stack up talent on your team, you are excited to see that as a fan, because the Raiders have so many other issues they need to fill, and just kind of getting, you know, maybe best player available, not a terrible move from a real-life perspective. Then we've got Brian Thomas Jr. to the Jags. The Gabe Davis era is over before it even begins. this is just funny to me. I mean, I know that Gabe Davis is still going to be there and be on the field and catch touchdowns every once in a while, whatever. But for the Jags to have, you know, Christian Kirk, Evan Engram, they let Calvin Ridley go. Gabe Davis goes somewhere that maybe he'll have a slightly more consistent role. And then Brian Thomas Jr. steps in. And I think he's just going to immediately be a better player than Gabe Davis. At the very least, he's going to render Gabe Davis completely useless in fantasy football. And I know that Brian Thomas Jr. getting drafted there actually led to the Jags cutting Zay Jones. So that is like the actual one-for-one replacement in terms of like role on the team. But Brian Thomas Jr. is going to eat into Gabe Davis's production like crazy. And Gabe Davis was already kind of a minimal and sporadic producer as it was. So I think this pick and this landing spot is very funny for my Gabe Davis kind of, you know, hater agenda. So I'm not upset about it at all. Xavier Worthy to the Chiefs. God damn it. Bills, what are we doing? Now, I know that receivers that are just purely predicated on speed, you know, they haven't worked out in the past, but I think Xavier Worthy has a little bit more to him than just speed. And to allow the Kansas City Chiefs, of all teams, to trade up with you and get Xavier Worthy, it's just wild to me. I guess the Bills must have liked Keon Coleman better than Xavier Worthy, but I just shudder to think of what the Chiefs offense is going to look like now with the biggest speedster in this draft now stretching the field for them. Because Rashee Rice might be going to the Gulag. He might be going to Alcatraz or wherever for the crimes he has committed. He may at the very least not be around for the start of the year. And so that would leave the Chiefs with what? Travis Kelce, what, Justin Watson, or they signed Hollywood Brown, excuse me. So they would have had those guys, but still not like a super deep complement of receivers again. Like as soon as it seemed like they might be reloading, because they would have had Kelce, Brown, Rice, that's damn good and good enough for Patrick Mahomes for sure. But it was like, oh, you know, the Rice situation is gonna dwindle them and maybe bring them down to earth a little bit. Nope, let's just add a guy who brings a completely different dynamic with him to the field, and he's going to be a big problem, I think. I just picture the Chiefs beating the Bills for the millionth time in the AFC Championship game, and it's because of like an Xavier Worthy touchdown, and Buffalo is just crying because they traded that pick. It feels to me like a pick that they are going to regret, and just a weird one. Weird one overall. I did not expect to see the Bills trade out. And at the very least, I didn't expect them to trade out with the Chiefs. Now, that'll do it for a little mini recap of the first round. But here are my favorite picks for the other rounds. First of all, Roman Wilson to the Steelers in round 3. Any receiver that the Steelers take in the second or third round has my attention. I made a video on it, and I referenced it a couple days ago, that the Steelers have a terrifying track record of drafting good receivers in the second and third round over the last like 15 years. You've got Mike Wallace, Emmanuel Sanders, Antonio Brown was a sixth rounder. You've got, gosh, who am I going to forget here? George Pickens was recently a sixth rounder. Martavis Bryant and Chase Claypool were both, you know, mid round picks, and they were both really good for a short stretch until they kind of fizzled out. The Steelers are just so good at identifying receiver talent. Oh, Deontay Johnson was the one I forgot. They're so good at identifying receiver talent in those mid rounds that the fact they decided to go get Roman Wilson tells me Roman Wilson might be the receiver steal of the draft, might be kind of the dark horse, you know, hidden talent at that position, and could outproduce a lot of receivers drafted ahead of him, both this year and throughout the course of his career. Now, this will be a different outlook if the Steelers end up trading for a Brandon Ayuk, if that kind of thing happens. They've been rumored to be in those discussions. But if they don't, and we head into this year with, I mean, I believe Roman Wilson is heading for a potential starting job, correct? Let me double check here with the Steelers depth chart. Obviously, Pickens is their one, but after they traded Deontay Johnson, I mean, there's nobody here really. Van Jefferson, Calvin Austin are currently their number 2 and number 3 receivers, so I don't think that's really insurmountable competition for Roman Wilson, so I'm definitely very interested in him. Braylon Trice to the Falcons in round 3, I love that move. Again, talked about how the Falcons had one of the least intimidating pass rushes in the game last season. Braylon Trice was a game wrecker for Washington, and I like that they picked him up in round 3. It kind of mitigated the mistake with Penix a little bit, and I guess the Falcons just really like the University of Washington. So I'm curious to see if Braylon Trice can, you know, put up some numbers that maybe are more reminiscent of a first-round draft pick, and then the Falcons didn't completely waste theirs. If they can find first-round value in a later round, then that'll make up for basically throwing their first-round pick away with Michael Penix. Spencer Rattler to the Saints in round 5. Love that pick. I'm actually in a group chat with one of my close friends is a Saints fan. In like 20-30 minutes before that pick, he was like, I'd really like to see the Saints pick up Rattler. I was like, you know what? That's a really good idea, because Derek Carr is just kind of a bum. You need some level of optimism in that building right now, at least for the fans' sake. And I think getting Spencer Rattler creates that, because if Derek Carr just comes out next year and starts mitting it up, starts stinking it up again to open the season, you've at least got a guy that you're like, maybe we start to think about, you know, throwing Spencer Rattler in there and seeing if we can extract some of that former first-round hype that Spencer Rattler used to have earlier in his college career. So I love that dart throw by the Saints. I think they are kind of the perfect team to make that move. That, look, they're locked up in cap hell. They have one of the most overall, like, bleak outlooks as far as the immediate future is concerned because they're in cap hell and don't have, like, a ton of talent on the roster right now. Getting Spencer Rattler creates just, like, that right amount of optimism that I think will keep fans at least engaged. And then, you know, if and when he does end up in the starting lineup, the Saints suddenly become an interesting story versus just having to play out you know, 17 games of Derek Carr, because I don't. If that happens, and it, I guess it might, if that happens, the fan base is just gonna be big sad. And then the last one I wanted to highlight here is Anais Smith to the Eagles in round 5. You guys may recall this time last year, I would mention here and there about Devon Achane out of Texas A&M, because my girlfriend, who is a Texas A&M alum, has subjected me to some Texas A&M football over the past couple seasons. You know, football games that I would not have watched otherwise, and sometimes there are just guys that catch your eye. Devon Achane was that guy to me, you know, a couple years ago, where I was just like, man, there's no way, forget the size, I don't care. There's no way this guy can't be a productive NFL player. And look, if he goes into a different situation, like a team that's not the Dolphins and not as proactive as a guy like Mike McDaniel is to try to leverage the talent on his team, maybe Achane would have never gotten a shot. But now that he's gotten the shot, I've been vindicated with that take that Devon Achane can be a super productive NFL player. I still never envisioned those heights that he reached last year while he was healthy, but still very, very good NFL player. And I kind of knew something was good with him. I knew he had a little something special. Anais Smith feels similar to me in that, look, he's a very undersized receiver. He's 5'10", and he's not going to ever be a volume NFL receiver, I don't think. It's not going to be like Achane has a chance to be the Dolphins RB1. Anais Smith is never going to be that, but Anais Smith is absolutely a name you need to know, because you're going to hear it on NFL Red Zone, and I promise you that. He went to the Eagles. The Eagles are, I think, a smart enough franchise to use him in ways that will leverage his skills, and with the rules now coming into effect this year that will encourage more kickoff returns, Anais Smith, I feel like, could be their kick returner, and if he is, he's going to house a couple this year. I have no doubt in my mind. His vision and fundamentals and acceleration, like, he's just been, you know, Texas A&M has struggled a bit over these past few seasons, but Anais Smith, when healthy, was just always the rock. Like, when you tuned in to an A&M game, he was the guy that was kind of the centerpiece, the focal point of their offense. Whenever they needed something, it was going to Anais Smith, and he pretty much always delivered. That type of player, I think, is just an absolute slam dunk as a depth receiver for the Eagles in round 5. And if he is ever, propelled into a bigger role due to injury, like, yes, he's undersized, but I think there's just so many fun ways you can use a player that's that talented. I expect to hear his name a lot in the NFL throughout the course of his career. So those are kind of the highlight picks of both the first round and then, you know, a couple in the later rounds. These are my overall draft winners and losers. We will start with the winners first. I am going to say the Patriots were winners in this draft, strictly because the ability to draft Drake May at number 3. I remember I was at the Patriots-Broncos game this past season where the Patriots inexplicably decided to win. I know the Broncos were terrible too, but the Patriots won that game at the end of the season, and I was like, this is going to take us out of Drake May contention, and I'm very sad. And it didn't. The Patriots got Drake May, who I believe is the second best quarterback prospect in this class. So getting him at number 3 is huge. Getting that potential franchise quarterback is huge. And again, just being able to identify players at positions of need that you really like and that complement each other is huge. So the Patriots start the post-Belichick era basically as good as they possibly can, in my opinion, addressing all those positions of need. It's going to be a slow build. I don't expect the Patriots to actually pull a Houston Texans and be like borderline playoff team this year and have everything work out that well, but they are setting themselves up for long-term success, and I think really just nailed the draft this year in what was, like, this was a draft they needed to nail to really set themselves up for the future, and I think they did that. The Philadelphia Eagles are the next one. The fact that they managed to come out of this draft with both Quinyon Mitchell and Cooper DeJean is a massive, massive haul for them. I figured they would get one of those guys. The fact they ended up getting two and basically shoring up the biggest liability they had on their roster, which was that secondary, is massive for them. So it's kind of hard to look at them as anything but one of the biggest winners, especially as they sit here as, you know, one of the major contenders still for a Super Bowl in the NFL. Obviously, last year fizzled out at the end. They had some problems that they had to address. They got two new coordinators this year. But I think the Eagles are still very much in that hunt atop the NFC. And getting these corners And whether Cooper plays corner or not doesn't really matter. Getting these guys in the secondary to hold things down, huge for them. Then I've got the Detroit Lions for, honestly, a lot of the same reasons. They were a pass funnel last year. For as good as they were and exceeding expectations and making the NFC Championship game where they narrowly lost to the 49ers, they needed to get some corners, and they did that with each of their first two picks as well. Terrion Arnold at number 24, and then Ennis Rakestraw Jr. from Missouri in the second round. Just sometimes you see teams with massive positions of need, and they just don't address them for whatever reason. They go best player available, or they trade out, or whatever. And then sometimes you just see teams do the logical thing and address the need that we all know they have. That's what the Patriots did. It's what the Eagles did. And it's what the Lions did, which is why I'm also marking them as one of my winners. This one may come as a surprise, but I'm going to say the Minnesota Vikings were a winner as well. Being able to get J.J. McCarthy, I mentioned that it was pick 11. They traded up one spot to pick 10 to get J.J. McCarthy. For them to get J.J. McCarthy and not have to trade, you know, all their assets up into the top five or six to get him, or even number four, is huge because, again, lower upside quarterback than some of the other guys in this class, but still a dart throw they had to take and a guy who could be a pretty good starter in this league if things break right. So being able to basically sit where they were and still get, you know, one of the tier one or I guess tier two quarterbacks in this draft was a pretty good value for them. And then also being able to trade up to number 17 and get Dallas Turner on the defensive side. This is like a diet version of what the Texans did last year, right? Getting Stroud at two and then Will Anderson at three. You've got cornerstones on both offense and defense that you picked in the first round. The Vikings did like a mini version of that. Now, J.J. McCarthy, I don't think is going to be anything near C.J. Stroud. And Dallas Turner, I guess Dallas Turner could be comparable to Will Anderson if things break right. But this was really, really good value on both these guys, in my opinion. Dallas Turner fell way too far. Dallas Turner should have just been the number 8 overall pick going to Atlanta. And then my final winner, I'm going to round it out, fifth winner here, is the Pittsburgh Steelers. Why? Because they focused on their O-line, which is going to help whatever quarterback they end up starting this year tremendously. Russell Wilson and Justin Fields both suffered greatly last year with Denver and Chicago just having porous offensive lines, especially Chicago. The Steelers making that a focus, I think, is going to get the best out of whichever one of those guys they end up starting. And then again, the Roman Wilson pick, eyes are wide open on that one, considering it's the Steelers taking him. So I think it was a very smart draft by Pittsburgh as well. The losers of the 2024 draft. I've only got two of them because no one else, I feel like, really screwed up their draft that badly. Obviously, you know, in a year, we'll be able to hindsight it and be like, oh, this team had literally zero impact playmakers that they ended up taking. But as far as justifying their picks for right now, there's only two teams that I think really kind of came away as being losers. The Falcons, duh. The Michael Penix pick was just a whiff. Like, it just doesn't make sense. Even if Michael Penix ends up being like a Pro Bowler, even if he ends up being like a top five quarterback in 4 years, it just doesn't make sense to throw away or ignore the Super Bowl window you have right now for hope in the future. Like, it's again a misalignment of priorities there for the Falcons. So just a bad move there. And then the other team I'm going to say, just if I have to, you know, kind of nitpick and find a loser, I'm going to go with the New York Giants just for not getting a quarterback. They were one of those teams. They were one of the teams along with the Vikings that reportedly were desperately trying to trade with the Patriots so that they could get Drake May at number 3. So they understand the need that they have. They just were unable to make the move to get the guy. And coming out of this draft, with it effectively meaning you have to burn another year with Daniel Jones, I think is a massive L, even if you get a guy like Malik Nabers who can be your wide receiver one for the next few years. Having shiny toys on offense is awesome, but not when you don't have a guy to get it to them. So I think they come out of losers partially through they come out as losers partially through no fault of their own, because at the end of the day, if the Patriots don't want to trade you, they don't want to trade with you. I think I would also be calling them losers if they traded, you know, 4 first-round picks to just make the Pats an offer they couldn't refuse. But it's still just hard to look at the Giants draft and think that this upcoming season is going to be anything but, you know, pretty big waste of time, if I'm being honest. All right, that'll do it for my initial draft reactions here. Real quick, we do have one piece of news. Ezekiel Elliott signs with the Cowboys. So the Cowboys, notably in the draft, did not take a running back. And I think that was surprising to a lot of people. Had a lot of folks mocking Texas's Jonathan Brooks to the Cowboys in the second round. That did not end up happening. Jonathan Brooks finds himself with the Panthers, and we will again discuss his fantasy value and the Panthers backfield next week when our boy Pat returns. But for now, the Cowboys not drafting a running back anywhere in the seven rounds was even more surprising than them not taking Jonathan Brooks, because now their backfield is just kind of a mishmash of dudes who are like decent. So I think Zeke immediately becomes their best running back again. Then he's there with, you know, the younger Rico Dowdle and then Royce Freeman, who they just brought in. Freeman actually had some okay games for the Rams last season. I don't think I'm mistaken with that. He moonlighted with the Rams last year, just like Darrell Henderson did. Yeah. Freeman was okay at times last year, but again, just kind of mediocre. And this just leaves the Cowboys with a messy running back room, and I feel like it leaves them with a run game that they're not really going to be able to rely on, at least not any more than they did last year. Because quite honestly, Tony Pollard was a bit of a disappointment last year from what we expected from him. He was just kind of fine most of the year. And so I think the Cowboys offense, we're kind of going to see much of the same, where they try to establish the run and hope that it's going to work because they like Zeke and they like Rico Dowdle. But at the end of the day, it's just not really going to move the needle that much. Zeke signs with the Cowboys. Zeke's back. Zeke will have some level of fantasy relevance, but it's just kind of an icky move overall, if you ask me. And as promised, guys, this is going to be a slightly shorter pod than normal, but I am going to end with our viewer questions. We got some good ones with the draft here, so let me hit that track.
We just got a letter. We just got a letter. We just got a letter. Wonder who it's from.
All right, first question from Dylan Hubanks. Could Penix get traded in a year or two? No. The answer is no. When you make a controversial pick like that, you have to stand by it. And I think we saw, I don't know if this is what was actually happening, but I don't know if you guys saw that clip of Terry Fontenot like explaining himself to Arthur Blank, the Falcons owner, about why they made that pick. But regardless, the GM and the front office and everyone has to stand by this pick now that they've made it. Trading it in a year or two is completely out of the question, because that would be immediately admitting they made a mistake. And the plan that the Falcon, or that Terry and I guess the rest of the Falcons have presented to us, is that, you know, it's okay if Kirk plays great throughout the duration of his contract, because that means things are working out. If they're okay with that, and they're telling us they would be okay with that, and obviously signing Kirk to a $180 million deal, I would hope means that they're okay with him playing well, means that they don't have any logical reason to trade Michael Penix, because to them, it would just be things are going according to plan if he continues to sit on their bench. Like, that's, I guess, what they want to do with him. So, no, there's no way they trade him unless a team came to them and offered, like, some crazy deal, which they're not going to do for a guy who hasn't played a snap in the NFL and who is not likely to play many snaps in the NFL in the next year or two. So, no, they will not trade Michael Penix in a year or two. I don't know. I'm not even going to say they could trade him in 3 years, because then you're getting to the point where he's actually getting close to playing if this timeline works out the way the Falcons want it to. So, no, Penix will not get traded from the Falcons unless Kirk, like, retires this year and then Penix is bad and then he gets traded a la Zach Wilson for, you know, a bad return. But, no, he won't get traded for any reason of, like, he's not playing enough and the Falcons want to get him to a team where he can actually play. Next question. Do you see the Bears winning the North, or has Detroit prepared enough? This question from Al Sand. I don't see the Bears. I'm not picking the Bears to win the North. I think the Bears can win the North. They have, you know, a lot of talent on that roster. And if Caleb Williams actually adjusts to the NFL, you know, hyper quickly, it's possible, because I think the Bears have the makings to have the best offense in that division. Defensively, they're not completely void of talent either. So it feels like getting ahead of myself to be like, yes, the Bears are definitely going to win the division considering they do have a rookie quarterback and the Lions and even Packers looked so good last year. So no, I'm not going to pick them to, but I do think they have a shot. And especially to answer the second part of your question, has Detroit prepared enough? Absolutely. Detroit making the NFC title game last year and being as good as they were. And I mean, how much did they win the division by last year? They won the division by 3 games last year. I think the Packers will make that a little bit closer, but to do that, to go 12-5 and then to, again, address your biggest weaknesses and not really have any major departures, I think Detroit is very much in position to run it back. Is Gus Edwards a good fantasy option? This question from TylerJS477. So right now, I'm going to say yes. And Gus Edwards, I shouldn't even say that. Gus Edwards will be fantasy relevant regardless of what happens next season. It's just, there is a chance that other players emerge in this backfield and kind of just make each other irrelevant or at least take the value from each other. Now you've got J.K. Dobbins there who is vowing to finally have a healthy year. Don't know how effective he's going to be, but he can still fill a role. Then you've got Kamani Vidal, a 6th-round pick out of Troy that the Chargers drafted. And again, remember, like, this is a new regime. Like, this isn't, nobody is coming in with like any sort of history with this team or this version of this team. Like, you are bringing in, yes, Gus Edwards and J.K. Dobbins have history with offensive coordinator Greg Roman, but at the end of the day, Harbaugh is going to be the one that has the final say on who is playing the most. So if this rookie comes in and impresses, he's going to play a lot. If, you know, J.K. Dobbins proves that he's healthy, he might play a lot over Gus Edwards. So yes, Gus Edwards absolutely has fantasy value. And at the very least, he'll probably be the goal line guy. I would just hesitate to say that he's going to have like consistent week to week fantasy value like we saw him have with the Ravens this past year, because he just ended up being kind of the only guy left and he was in a very productive offense. I don't know that he'll end up being the only guy left this year. J.K. Dobbins, you know, as much as I'm not going to say like he's going to bounce back and finally be the elite guy that we saw coming out of Ohio State, there's a good chance that he just actually does stay healthy all year, but is a sort of watered down version of what he used to be because of all the injuries, especially the Achilles tear that tends to be kind of a death knell for running backs, at least for their complete productivity. But like if he's healthy, he's going to take a bunch of carries and it's not going to be as clear cut of a path for Gus Edwards. So he's a fantasy option, Gus Edwards is, but I don't know that I'm like banking on him as like an RB2 or anything like that heading into next year. And then from Kylo27, he says, top 5 power ranking post-draft. So the draft didn't really change power rankings a lot for me because like no single or no handful of draft picks is going to be enough for me to be like, oh, that team is suddenly a contender because of who they drafted. You know, we have to see how the drafted guys play out and then we'll know if there's anyone that's actually making game-breaking difference for their team and ascends them into contendership, kind of like, again, Stroud with the Texans last year. I wouldn't have said the Texans are contenders, but Stroud essentially turned them into one. But my top 5 power ranking post-draft, number 1, got to go with the Chiefs. They are just kind of going to be number 1 in the power rankings for ever, maybe. As long as Mahomes and Andy Reid and Travis Kelce and Chris Jones are all there, which they are, it's hard to not put the Chiefs at number 1. Number 2, I'm actually going to go with the Baltimore Ravens. I think the Ravens with Derrick Henry in the mix now are better suited to actually knock the Chiefs off next season. They obviously didn't do it this past year, and they just sillily abandoned their run game in that game against Kansas City. Having Derrick Henry will not allow them to do that, and I just think the Ravens top to bottom are super, super talented, and they're my 2nd-best team right now. Number 3, I'm going to go with the San Francisco 49ers. This is not any hate on the Niners. I could easily have put them at 2. Similar to the Ravens, loaded both sides of the ball, great coaching, just kind of easy to keep them in that top 3. And then my number 4 and 5, I guess, were slightly influenced by the draft because these teams could have been maybe passed up by some other teams if the draft went differently. But I'm going to go with the Eagles at number 4. I think bringing in those new coordinators and addressing the secondary is going to make them major contenders again and not have them kind of go into the playoffs and just fizzle out. Excuse me, that's my reminder hitting. I think they'll be a force to be reckoned with again this year, especially with that new secondary. And then For similar reasons, I'm going to put the Detroit Lions at number 5 because they addressed that secondary. Maybe I had the Lions too low. Again, made the NFC title game last year, but I think the Lions, all these teams are really very similar in like closeness as far as the ranking goes. It's just these are the top 5 in, and I had to put them in order. But the Lions, they are kind of running it back. They managed to keep Ben Johnson around, which is huge, and they have just done nothing but improve since last season, which, like, I can't say the same about the Cowboys, who have kind of just watched pieces walk out the door and not really do a whole lot to replace them. So I think the Lions slot in at number 5, and that is my top 5 power ranking post-draft. Guys, thank you for tuning in to this solo episode of Off the Bench. I promise we will have another voice in here next week. And thank God, because I think I'm losing mine and my mouth is dry. I took a couple sips of water in the middle of the show, but that was about it. And I need somebody to let my mouth rest, Ayo. But that'll do it for this episode of Off the Bench. Tune in next week for some fantasy analysis of the NFL draft and the return of the esteemed Pat Gustafson. But for now, for just me, thank you for tuning in. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.